The north was Seleucus Nicator. The south was Ptolemy Lagus. So it would be divided toward the four winds of heaven. It was in four parts, and it was scattered in different directions. And not to his posterity. Now what that means is that his family did not succeed him. And Mr. Clark goes into a lot of detail here to show what happened to each member of Alexander's family. His wife, his children, his brother, all of his family were killed. So that his posterity didn't participate in the ruling of these four. And also, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, it wasn't according to the precepts of Alexander even. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now this king of the south was Ptolemy Lagus, the king of Egypt. He was one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And then he had a man working under him, this Seleucus Nicator, whom the Bible describes here as being one of his princes. He then became the ruler of Syria. And so Syria and Egypt were the two major powers now during this time. And who was caught right in between these two major powers? Palestine, Judea, Jerusalem, God's people. And they've been for years and years a little narrow section of land that great powers from the north and great powers from the south have to trample over as they go back and forth in their battles and in the dealings with each other. That's right where God's people are, in Judea. So that the remainder now of the bulk of this prophecy, up to about verse 30 or 31, is these two powers now dealing with each other. Verse 6, and in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now we have on the blackboard over there the names of these kings. I've tried to straighten them out as much as I can, and it's, without knowing this history, or without having a good outline of history, it's a little difficult. But what happened here in this sixth verse, the second Ptolemy, the one who followed Ptolemy Lagus, was known as Ptolemy Philadelphus. He was Ptolemy II. His daughter was named Bernice. And so the man who followed Seleucus Nicator of the north, who was Antiochus Theos, or Antiochus II, he married Bernice. They made an alliance. Now, verse 6 says, and in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So he married Bernice, this king's daughter of the south. And the purpose now was that one king was trying to get the best of the other king through this daughter. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Let's read what Mr. Clark said. Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus, the king of Egypt, was married to Antiochus Theos, the king of Syria. These two sovereigns had a bloody war for some years, and they agreed to terminate it by the above marriage on condition that Antiochus would put away his wife, Laodice, and her children, which he did. And Berenice, having brought an immense fortune to her husband, all things appeared to go on well for a time. Now the remainder of the verse says, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her. Antiochus recalled his former wife Laodice and her children, and she, fearing that he might recall Berenice, caused him to be poisoned and her to be murdered, and sent her son Callinicus upon the throne. Now this Callinicus is Seleucus Callinicus, and he's really Seleucus the second here. And they that brought her up, that would be her Egyptian women who were striving to defend their mistress, were many of them killed. And he that begat her, which really means the one that she begat, which was her son, he was killed. And he that strengthened her in these times, which was actually her father, and he had died about this time, or maybe a few years before this time. So the alliance didn't work out like they thought it would, and like this king of the south thought it would. For his daughter was killed, and all of her household were killed, her husband was killed, and then he died. Now, verse 7. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. A branch from the same root from which she sprang, this was Ptolemy Eurgetes, her brother. Now, you notice we've got him listed down there under Bernice on our board over there. He was her brother, who to avenge his sister's death marched with a great army against Seleucus Callinicus, took some of his best places, indeed all Asia, from Mount Taurus to India, and returned to Egypt with an immense bounty, 40,000 talents of silver, precious vessels, and images of their gods, 2,500, without Callicus daring to offer him battle. And then Mr. Clark says, I can but touch on these historical facts for fear of extending these notes to an immoderate length. Well, they're long enough, the way he cut them down. I'm glad he didn't go much longer. Verse 8, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Well, he lived 4 or 5 years longer than the king of the north did at this time. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. Now this would be this Ptolemy Eurgetes, which is the brother of Bernice. He came into this kingdom of the north, and then he returned into the south. And the reason he returned was that having heard that a sedition was taking place in Egypt, Ptolemy was obliged to return speedily in order to repress it, else he had wholly destroyed the kingdom of Callinicus. But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. Now his sons, that is, the sons of Callinicus, who were Seleucus, Serenus, and Antiochus. We've got them listed up there. Now, they're found in verse 10 here. These two sons were stirred up and said that they shall assemble a multitude of great forces. Seleucus Serenius did assemble a multitude of forces in order to recover his father's dominions, but not having money to pay them, they became mutinous, and he was poisoned by two of his own generals. His brother Antiochus was then proclaimed king, so that only one of the sons did certainly come and overflow and pass through. He retook Seleucia and regained Syria. He then returned and overcame Nicolaus, the Egyptian general, and seemed disposed to invade Egypt as he came east to the frontiers of Egypt. The remainder of verse 10, he shall certainly come and overflow through, then shall he return up even to his fortress. That's talking about this Antiochus. And he's known as Antiochus III, or also as Antiochus the Great. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler. And we know that word choler means anger. And shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Now this king of the south is Ptolemy Philopater, who succeeded his father Ergetes, and we have him listed on the board there, verse 11. He did come forth to Raphia, where he was met by Antiochus, when a terrible battle was fought between these two kings. And he, that is Antiochus, the king of the north, shall set forth a great multitude, amounting to 62,000 foot, 6,000 horse, and 102 elephants. And yet the multitude was given into his hand, the hand of the king of the south, for Ptolemy gained a complete victory. Raphia and other neighboring towns declared for the victor, and Antiochus was obliged to retreat with his scattering army to Antioch, from which he sent to solicit a peace. Now, verse 12, and when he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many ten thousands, but he shall not be strengthened by it. Had Ptolemy improved his victory, he might have dispossessed Antiochus of his whole empire. But giving way to pride and a criminal sensual life, he made peace on dishonorable terms, and though he had gained a great victory, yet his kingdom was not strengthened by it, for his subjects were displeased and rebelled against him, or at least became considerably disaffected. Now, as I said earlier, we're in some very deep prophecy. It seems like that it's dull and dry in a lot of ways. The miraculous thing about it is that he does predict these events with such precise accuracy. And so I beg you just to bear with me as we get through some of this, because this is still a part of the book of Daniel, and there are several more verses of relating this history. Verse 13, for the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. In about 14 years, Antiochus did return, Philopater being dead, and his son Ptolemy Epiphanes being then a minor. He brought a much larger army and more riches. These he had collected in a late eastern expedition. Verse 14, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. Now, the robbers of thy people, these are thought to be the Jews who revolted against the established religion of Judea, and they joined Ptolemy, and according to the scholars, what they did, they went into Egypt and tried to fulfill a prophecy found in Isaiah 30 about the temple being built down there, and so they tried to fulfill that, but it never did come to pass. So he calls them, the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fail. In other words, they felt this vision should be interpreted a certain way in Isaiah, so they went down to establish it, to bring it about, but they failed. Verse 15, so the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So now we see the king of the north beginning to prevail. This, of course, is Antiochus the Great, or Antiochus the Third. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now on his way down, and on, during his campaign, he came to Palestine, where Jerusalem was, where the temple was. He stood in the glorious land. That's what it's referred to here, is the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Mr. Clark says, for he reduced Palestine, and the Jews supplied him with provisions, and assisted him to reduce the garrison that Scopas had left in the citadel of Jerusalem. Antiochus showed the Jews great favor. He brought back those that were dispersed and reestablished them in the land, freed the priests and Levites from all the tributes. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. That's verse 17. Let's read what Mr. Clark says about that verse. Antiochus purposed to have marched his army into Egypt, but he thought it best to proceed by fraudulence, and therefore proposed a treaty of marriage between him and his daughter Cleopatra, called here the daughter of women because of her great beauty and accomplishments. Now, this is not the same Cleopatra that we read about in the history who married Julius Caesar and saved her kingdom of Egypt from destruction by the Romans. She reigned about 35 to 45 B.C. This woman here came about 100 years before this time, and the Cleopatra we know of was probably named for her, but this Cleopatra was the daughter of Antiochus, and he wanted to make a fraudulent treaty with Egypt by having the Egyptian king to marry his daughter. And of course, that king that married his daughter was Ptolemy Epiphanes. But he intended his daughter to be a snare to Ptolemy, and therefore proposed to corrupt her that she might betray her husband. But now he says in this verse 17, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. So the daughter didn't go along with this. On the contrary, her husband's interest became more dear to her than her father's, and by her means Ptolemy was put upon his guard against the intentions of Antiochus. Verse 18. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles and take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Antiochus had fitted out a great fleet of 100 large ships and 200 smaller, and with this fleet subdued most of the maritime places on the coast of the Mediterranean, and took many of the isles, Rhodes, Samos, Euboea, Colophon, and others. And verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. After this shameful defeat, Antiochus fled to Sardis, thence to Apamea, and the next day he got into Syria, into Antioch, his own fort, whence he sent ambassadors to treat for peace, and was obliged to engage to pay the immense sum of money mentioned above. Now, I didn't read what had happened above. The consul, Achillas Glabrio, caused the reproaches to cease. He beat and routed his army at the Straits of Thermopylae and expelled him from Greece, so he obliged him to pay the tribute which he hoped to impose on others. Now, this is Antiochus being defeated. For he would grant him peace only on conditions of paying the expense of the war. 15,000 talents. This was 500 on the spot, 2,500 when the peace should be ratified by the Senate, and the remaining 12,000 in 12 years, each year 1,000. So when he went back to Antioch, he'd been defeated. He had been obliged to pay a tremendous amount of money to Greece, and that was the only way he got away alive, and he was humiliated and obliged to pay the immense sum of money that was mentioned above. But the scripture says, he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Being under the greatest difficulties how to raise the stipulated sums, he marched into his eastern provinces to exact the arrears of taxes and attempted to plunder the temple of Jupiter Belus at Elymas. He was opposed by the populace, and he and his attendants were slain. Now, this is the account given by several of the historians, but it is variously related by others, some saying that he was assassinated by some of his own people, whom he'd punished for being drunk at a feast. St. Jerome says he lost his life in a battle against the inhabitants of Elymas. In short, the manner of his death is uncertain, and perhaps even the circumstances referred to by the prophet when he says, he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Now, what Mr. Clark is saying is this phrase, not be found, would indicate that nobody would really know exactly how he did die. You know, it may be kind of like Hitler at the end of World War II. We had all kinds of accounts as to what happened to Hitler, as though nobody really knew, although I think it is known. But this man, the historians are divided as to how he died. Well, the Bible says he'd stumble and fall and not be found. Now, verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the kingdom, and within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now this person that stood up ultimately was his son, Seleucus Philopater, which is listed there on the board. And he didn't die as a result of battle, like the Bible says. Seleucus Philopater succeeded his father Antiochus. He sent his treasurer to seize the money deposited in the temple of Jerusalem, which is here called the glory of the kingdom. He was so cramped to pay the annual tax to the Romans that he was obliged to burden his subjects with continual taxes. Now he shall be destroyed neither in anger, that is, he wasn't destroyed fighting against an enemy, nor in battle, or that is, at the head of his troops, but basely and treacherously by the hand of his treasurer, who hoped to reign in his stead. So we have the end then of this Seleucus Philopater. Verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now this vile person is the last king we have named over there of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was one that... they didn't give the honor of the kingdom. That is, they didn't select him as the king. He got in by deceit. He got in by false pretenses, but he came in a peaceable manner. He didn't conquer it. And he obtained the kingdom by flatteries, the Bible says. And it's amazing how each one of these kings and each of these events is so precisely, by Daniel, hundreds of years happened. Some of these 200 and 400 years came to pass are related to Daniel. Verse 20, and with the arms of a shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now, the arms which were overthrown before him were his competitors for the crown. They were vanquished by the forces of Eumenes and Attalus, and were dissipated by the arrival of Antiochus from Athens, whose presence disconcerted all their measures. And it says that, yea, also the prince of the covenant. The prince of the covenant was Onias, the high priest, whom he removed and put Jason in his place, who had given him a great sum of money, and then put wicked Melanias in his room, who had offered him a larger sum. Thus he acted deceitfully in the league made with Jason. So we see him affecting Jerusalem very definitely. He's affecting the rule of the temple. He takes one high priest out, he puts another in, and that one pays him more money, and he takes him out and puts another in his place. So what the Bible is showing here is the condition the world would be in when the Jews were occupying this land before the Messiah came. How that they would be pushed and pulled. They'd be run over, they'd be captured by one, released by another, they'd have their very worship affected, and that would be a most important thing for God's people to know that was going to happen to them. Just as the book of Revelation tells what's going to happen to the church, that's most important for God's people to know. And so this is what he is telling them precisely in this prophecy. After the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Now, this is still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And he's one of the most prominent of the rulers of this time. He shall come up, this is from Rome, where he had been a hostage for the payment of the tax laid on his father. Now, he's still laboring under this payment of taxes that his father was required to pay when he lost that great battle over there. And so he was then held as a hostage, and he came up then from that, shall become strong with a small people. At first he had but few to espouse his cause when he arrived in Antioch, the people having been greatly divided by the many claimants of the crown, but being supported by Emmanuel and Attalus, his few people increased, and he became strong. Now, verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the stronghold even for a time. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places, that be the very richest provinces, which was Coelesyria and Palestine. He shall do which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall become profuse in his liberalities and scattered among them the prey of his enemies, the spoil of temples and the riches of his friends, as well as his own revenues. He spent much in public shows and bestowed largesses among the people. We're told that in the liberal giving of gifts he abounded above all the kings that went before him. These are nearly the words of the prophets, and perhaps without any design to copy them on the part of the apocryphal writer. He would sometimes go into the street and throw about a handful of money, crying out, "Let him take it to whom fortune sends it." Let's just take another verse or two, then we'll quit here. He shall forecast his devices. As Iulus and Lanius, who were the guardians of the young Egyptian king Ptolemy Philometor, demanded from Antiochus the restitution of Coelesyria and Palestine, which he refused, he foresaw that he might have a war with that kingdom, and therefore he forecast devices. He fixed a variety of plans to prevent this, visited the strongholds and frontier places to see that they were in a state of defense, and this he did for a time. He employed some years in hostile preparations against Egypt. Well, we'll stop there with that 24th verse, and then we'll begin next time with the 25th verse, Lord willing. We hope that we won't have to spend too much more time now until we get on down into the more pertinent parts of this prophecy, which will begin about the 30th and 31st verses when we get into the New Testament age and the invasion of Rome, or that is the interference of Rome with the people of God who would have been the Christians during the early times of the church. Does anybody have any questions or comments up to now? Again, I'd like to say that I know this seemed like a very dull and dry session tonight, but there's just no way of getting around it. These prophecies are here. They're a part of Daniel. If we're going to take it verse by verse, well, we're going to have to cover them the best we can. They did require, although it seems kind of dull, it did require a tremendous amount of study just to try to figure out some of the meaning that is had here and how to make an application of it. Because I, for one, am completely unlearned in this segment of world history. If nothing further, then, Lord willing, next Tuesday we'll begin with this 25th verse of chapter 11.